Dentistry is changing. Technology, education, and resources are closer to our fingertips now more than ever. Are you ready to learn what millennial dentists are doing to exceed patient expectations, enjoy dentistry more, and take more vacations? Or how this generation can join up with the previous ones to make for an unstoppable dental team? Well, wait no longer. Here are your hosts of The Millennial Dentist, Dr. Holsinger, Dr. Payray, and Dr. Sully Sullivan.
Dude, welcome back, everyone, to the Millennial Dentist Podcast. Pretty stoked to be here. You may notice that we sound really nice, and that's because we are not recording with my stuff, but we are live at Spear Studio. This is a nice set.
It's pretty nice, yeah.
I feel like I'm not in my own home. I'm using another person's kitchen. So we'll see how that goes. But without further ado, I am very, very excited to introduce our next guest, Dr. Darren Deister.
Hey, thanks. And welcome to my kitchen.
I feel like you should be the one introducing everyone here.
Yeah. So for the viewers at home or the listeners, we're in the studio where we film a lot of our recorded video content. So I spend a ton of time down here. And the only way, honestly, you can get in front of a camera and not freak out is to get used to the environment.
Which is not easy to do. No. I did my first one this morning and...
Oh, nice. How'd you like it?
It's just a totally different experience.
Yeah.
I'm used to talking to people, right?
Yeah. It's just you and a camera. It's the weirdest thing ever.
No feedback. Yeah, I'm pretty sure I was terrible, but
yeah,
it's all right.
I'm sure you're awesome, but it's so weird. I sometimes go home just broken. I
get that.
Yeah.
Your pH wasn't right.
My pH wasn't right. My electrolytes were off and there was no applause or anything. So it's weird.
You probably get a lot of applause from that. Well, look, we have so much to cover. We have so much to cover, and I just want to jump right into content. Well, I don't really know where this is going to go, but here's typically how I like to do things. Give people a little bit of your background. Obviously, we're here at Spear Education. You're a faculty member here, and you teach workshops. One that I'm doing this week, which I'm super excited about. But let's go back a little bit and talk about maybe how you got into dentistry. And your road, because you also have a unique road, I know, about being a general dentist for a while and then going back to PROS, right?
Yeah. I took a little unorthodox path. I mean, I came to PROS pretty late, so similar in some ways to Jeff Rouse. But, you know, to go back in time, I grew up in a small town. I was kind of in between like Olympia, Washington and Seaside, Oregon, both really small towns. Seaside in particular, you know, actually, it wasn't even Seaside. Seaside's big. I lived in Gearhart, and there's like 1,000 people there. And, you know, I went to college at University of Oregon. No idea what I wanted to do. I fell into the health sciences because I'm drawn to science. I really dig the process. And I have a good family friend, actually, a couple good family friends who are dentists. And I used to ski with them and fish with them and stuff like that. And so I kind of thought, well, that looks pretty sweet. So I took the DAT and I did really well.
What was your score?
It was the old scoring system.
Oh, okay.
Yeah. So it's.
I was going to see if I beat you.
Yeah. I don't know.
I'm pretty sure I just got in by the skin of my teeth. That's all you need.
I know for sure I wouldn't get into dental school today.
Dude, you're right? Kidding.
Yeah. It's brutal. So I somehow managed to get into dental school, but there was like this moment right before I went where I used to ski a lot. I used to spend a lot of time in the mountains and I surfed a lot too. So that's kind of what I was doing on the Oregon coast. But I got kind of a job situation where I could go move to a ski resort and kind of start my training to become a backcountry ski guide. And they were off. We were talking about doing all the guiding and stuff like that. So you start at the bottom, right? Sure. But I was kind of set up for that. And so I had this moment like, well, I've been accepted to dental school and it's the summer and like, I gotta decide, right? So I'm like, I really struggled with this situation. So I ended up going to dental school. Otherwise, you know, I'd be on a different podcast, I'm sure.
It was funny. It's funny you say that because I had a kind of a similar, a little bit of a similar experience. And obviously we don't have mountains with snow or oceans in Nashville, Tennessee. But we do have lakes.
Yeah.
I was a huge wakeboard water ski guy all growing up. Actually, wakeboard in college and was like pretty good. And there was this moment where I had to decide, okay, do you want to move to Florida and like try to go pro and live your life in board shorts and flip flops, which essentially would be the same thing. You know, you move and you like live your life in ski gear and, grow a big beard and the whole nine yards. Or it was like, okay, or I go to dental school, I make a good living and then I can pay to ski or wakeboard, whatever I want.
Exactly.
That was kind of my, what got me there.
Exactly. Probably. Right. I mean, it's like, okay, you can be in the mountains or you can be wherever, like for your job, and you're going to have to get up and you actually have to go, or you can go on vacation. Right. And so it sounded pretty good to be able to do that on vacation. And so I guess.
When I always wonder, like, you think like, I mean, obviously the ski guys got to love that, but at some point would it be not as fun doing it every day? At least that's what I like to tell myself, that I'm not missing out.
Yeah, I think, I mean, there's probably some days that suck just like anything else, and it's brutal on your body. You know, I just was up in Banff, Calgary, Alberta, Banff, up in the mountains there last week, and I was working with a couple guides, and you know, it's just like, I don't know how to say this nicely. It's tough to age well
in that
environment.
Yeah, I get it.
And then I know, I got into kiteboarding kind of early when that hit North America, and I know guys who, went pro and got in the industry and stuff like that. And it's just, it's tough to make a living in that world for sure.
Yeah. Well, especially now when you look back where you are probably and where they are, it's different. Not to say better or worse, but it's different.
It's not better or worse. No, it's different. I mean, I got a good friend in Idaho in the mountains, who's got a backcountry ski service with a couple of yurts, and he's, spending all summer getting ready for it, and all winter, he's got some guides working for him now. So he's not even working every day. It's pretty sweet.
Man, this is Carson. I did not need to go off this tangent, but this is like bro dentist time right here.
Yeah, we can just continue our bro out. Yeah.
I'm sorry, we'll come back to dentistry.
Yeah, okay, I feel like we need flannels.
Yeah, I do too. Okay, so then you go on to dental school. Where'd you go to dental school?
Oh, yeah. So let's get back to that. So I applied to a couple of places, but I'm an Oregon kid. And I really wanted to stay in Oregon if I was going to practice. And so I applied to a couple of dental schools. I got into my first choice, Oregon Health Sciences in Portland. And the idea was, that's a school that at the time was really, the curriculum was really sort of set up to make or to grow really good general clinicians, right? And that's at the time what I wanted to do. But as a result, we didn't have a lot of grad programs there. There's kind of a small grad perio program, a really small oral surgery program, but we didn't have pros. So I was never exposed to pros residents or kind of like what pros was all about. But I finished dental school, and I remember sitting around a table one time, a couple of friends and one of our instructors who was a prosthodontist in were like, yeah, thinking about, applying for a residency or whatever. And, the consensus around the table was, why would you do something like that? Including my instructor. He's like, why would you do that? Just go work. If you find something you really like, you can spend some time learning more about that, and you can do that, right? As a general practitioner. So that's actually, I took his advice, and I didn't do any residency after dental school. And this is the 90s, right? It's not as prevalent as it is now. So I get out of dental school. I go work with a good family friend, kind of a bigger town on the Oregon coast, my family dentist. And so I practiced there for a year. Decided that I was going to try and do something else. So I started a practice from scratch, actually in my town. So 1,000 people back to Gearhart. 1,000 people built the office from scratch. So like the first day I had one patient and kind of built that for the next 10 years.
So did you find that like out of the gate? I mean, obviously, different financial reasons, different reasons why now some people would go or not go into residency. But did you find, did you regret that decision at all? Was that a good decision? Because that's obviously something we discuss all the time is whether students who graduate and go right into work, should they go to a residency? And that's just an interesting discussion.
Yeah, I don't know the answer to that really, because I mean, there's so much that factors into it, especially with the kids today. And I say kids, it could be anyone coming out of dental school. The debt situation is so high. I felt like my debt was high and I was well under 100,000, right? It was ridiculously under 100,000. But I still felt like, man, I don't want this thing to be on my neck for the next 40 years. So I was kind of anxious to get to work and actually do something. On the other hand, The stuff that we're doing in practice is so complex today. If you're slinging amalgam,
it's true.
No problem, right? You can learn how to do that in a couple years in dental school and be super competent at it. But if you want to do really high-end stuff where, you know, you've got really sensitive techniques and materials that we're working with, yeah, I think having some extra, you know, years to kind of just do that with someone looking over your shoulder can be really helpful.
So let me go on that a little bit then, because you bring up an interesting point, and that's, you know, dentistry is changing like crazy right now, just from a material standpoint, from a technology standpoint. There's so many different ways to do things. There's just so many advancements. Yet dental school at its core is still 4 years. How do you feel like our education's preparing us? Or is it not preparing us as well? Or talk a little bit about what you think about, you know, dental education, because I know you've done stuff with Oregon, over the past. Talk about that a little bit.
Yeah, I've been involved with kind of some curriculum discussions and philosophical discussions at the university level. And dental schools kind of take two approaches, right? There's the dental school that I experienced at UCLA, where the program is designed to get you ready to do the next step, which might become a basic scientist, right? A professional researcher, or to go into a residency or a grad program somewhere. But that's UCLA's program. There are other dental schools, one that I lecture here in the Phoenix area, it's designed to make really good general clinicians, kind of like the experience that I had at Oregon, right? And so as a applicant for dental schools, it would be helpful, I think, to know kind of what you want to do.
Very much so.
But man, how are you supposed to know that? So it's, yeah.
I think that's even hard in the residency aspect of it, because to me, gosh, right now I feel like when you look at, you know, either GPRs or AGDs or just whatever it is, there's not like a standard there. I mean, they are all over the place. I mean, some programs you place one implant, some programs you place 100 implants. I mean, you know, kind of knowing, because that's a question I always ask back is, well, do you have an idea of kind of what you want to do after, you know, this is past once they've at least done some dentistry, because the program you go into can make or break the reasoning for you going into the program to begin with.
For sure. And some programs, you know, are going to be really geared towards what you want, be really heavy on surgery or placing implants or whatever. Some are going to be a little bit heavier, you know, let's say on endo, right? Sure. So it's a matter of what you want to do. But if I think, you know, if I was looking back and saying, well, okay, which residency do I want to do or where do I want to go? It would be so helpful to know where you want to practice and how you want to practice. If you can figure that kind of stuff out, and I realize that answer is going to change over time, right?
Right, very much so.
But the more you can sort of think about stuff like that, the easier the answer is to come up with.
All right, so you've gone back to your hometown.
Yeah,
practicing. You've been there 10 years.
Yeah.
What was pros, cons, good, bad, ugly?
There's a lot of pros to working in a small town. There are some cons, right? So. In terms of anonymity, if I go to the coffee shop, let's say, or if I want to go to Starbucks, and we didn't get a Starbucks until pretty late in the game, but if I want to go have a cup of coffee, like I'm surrounded by my patients. And so it's like you can't get away from work. So to me, that was a little bit of a challenge, right? There are days where, you know, you may be coming back from doing whatever, right? And you're maybe not having the best day. And then you see someone in the parking lot and that's when they decide that they want to complain about something or, yeah. Hey doc, I got a toothache. I had people who weren't patients figure out where I lived.
No way.
Come to my house when they had toothaches and stuff like that. So it just I was really a part of the community. And I mean, I spent 5 or 6 years as a member of the volunteer fire department there. I've got a lot of relatives there. To this day, I've got a lot of, you know, my best friends still live there. And so I think, you know, if I was going to start a practice today, I think I would still go back to a small town. Yeah. So it's, you know, compared to where my next stop was in Portland, Oregon, a much bigger, you know, metro area. It's a lot easier to kind of get your footing in practice.
So was the big reason you left those reasons just kind of like, hey, you know, I'm ready to go be somewhere bigger or experience more? Or what was the big reason that you left that? A girl?
Well, yeah, in a sense. So I like a lot of people, I got divorced, and this was kind of a tough situation. And psychologically, it was really hard on me. Sure. To be in a small town, to be in my practice and kind of have patients who are caught up in that stuff. And it was just so much drama. It was cleaner for me to, you know, kind of sever that. Awesome. And, you know, it's kind of moving to a larger city. I felt like, well, my ex-wife could move there and we could continue to kind of do our thing and support the kids and stuff. And it didn't actually work out that way. But that was my thought with moving to Portland. Yeah. And all my connections were in Portland too, right? So all my referral network was there. My interdisciplinary team, the study club, all that stuff was up in Portland. So 90 minutes away, not super far, but a big change practice.
How did you get involved in a lot of that? Like, where did your education start to kind of advance and go beyond dental school dentistry during that time? Because obviously by the time you moved to Portland, it sounds like you have quite the network and group of people that you're surrounding yourself with.
Yeah, I was, I don't say I was at the top of my game, but I'd worked really hard at trying to become a good clinician. And part of that, I got to attribute to a good friend of mine, Bernie Taylor, who was the executive director. She's since passed away, but good friend, actually the mother of one of my classmates in dental school. And she was the executive director of the Oregon Academy of General Dentistry. And I was at a lecture and she grabbed me. So I'm like maybe 3 days out of dental school, something like that. And she grabs me and says, you know, here's our study clubs. Which one are you signing up for?
No way.
And just like your mother would, right? I mean, she literally grabbed my ear and she pushed my head down, look at this list of study clubs. It's like, not like, which one are you going to take?
Yeah, what an option.
So I that's kind of how I got into that. And I was involved. I'm still involved with the Oregon Academy of General Dentistry on some levels. And it's a great organization. It was a great learning experience for me. And that's where I met some of my first mentors. Yeah, for sure.
Well, and that's such a huge, I mean, people will, you know, we get that a lot from new practice owners or young dentists who get out on this island. And it's so easy to, once you graduate dental school, once you become a practice owner, to then live in your bubble and, you know, in that and with your team and not have any sort of professional peer-to-peer, you know, pushing or, you know, discussion and whatnot. It's actually kind of a long time coming, but we're actually starting our own beer study club actually next month. We were our first meeting.
Oh, congratulations.
So I know, we're super pumped about that. And we have a good group of core dentists that we've been doing kind of something like it, but just poorly, because we would try to either bring our own stuff or, you know,
it's hard.
It is. And when you're trying to run a practice, have a family and do all this other stuff, trying to prepare to put something like that on and do it, and then we all have, you know, things going on, it's difficult. So we're excited about that aspect of it. Cause I think, to me, it sounds like, from what I'm hearing from you, and I know already for me, that's such a critical key to our success.
Yeah, I agree. So, you know, I was in a couple study clubs, but the one that was really impactful for me in the regard or the sense with my patients, right, that like really tactical hands-on stuff, was a study club that I was in that included the periodontist that I was primarily working with, the orthodontist that I was working with, and the endodontist, he kind of came
out,
came once in a while. But
brought the beer.
not even that.
Like, come on, man.
But, you know, that we set it up, we modeled it after kind of the way that Frank Spear used to talk about his study clubs, right? So we didn't have the content that would come from an organization,
yeah.
Right? So today I would go to a Spear study club all day long. But in those days, what we did was, because we had cases that we were working on together, we'd bring cases, but we didn't just bring new cases. We'd bring cases that, we want to treatment plan these. We brought cases that we were in the middle of.
Gotcha.
And we brought cases that we had finished sometime previously. And so we would look at those older cases. That's really where we learned a lot. Like,
so what would you do differently kind of conversations?
Yeah, yeah, yeah. Here was our plan. We all could, you know, had the same vision on this thing. How'd we do? And if it's not perfect, like, what would you do differently, you know? So that then would translate into, okay, looking at these new cases, what do we want to do differently? And it was really helpful to keep us from falling into that trap where you're doing the same thing every time.
Or not raising. I mean, I see that all the time on like Facebook groups or Instagram or wherever, where people will be like, you know, they'll get done with a case and they'll be like, well, the patient loved it, you know, and then that becomes the bar. Yeah. And the problem is when the patient satisfaction is the bar, that's sometimes a very low bar. Like, you know, I mean, we got to look at it. We should be the ones with the highest standard, you know? And so then you got to start looking at things more clinically and being like, gosh, I look back at some of my stuff early on and I'm like, oh my gosh, that was terrible.
Yeah. But I mean, you got to appreciate that, you know, our bar changes over time.
Exactly. Because you don't know what you don't know, right?
Yeah. So I'm cool with that. You know, if you think it looks good, the patient's stoked about it, that's awesome. You know, that's kind of what we're going for. But, you know, same time, I realize, hey, I could always be better.
Sure.
So if I was going to do this better, I was going to have a better outcome, what would I do? And so a great example of that, right, is a patient who's got a low lip line, big, heavy, thick lip, right? Mm-hmm. So you're never going to see the gingival levels. Do you have to, you know, scramble to try and manage the perfect gingival architecture? No.
Of course not. But
there is the patient you'll need that skill set with. So if you're ever going to practice, you got a patient that's who's willing to go for it. Yeah, I mean, think about it. So that's my thought.
That's a good point. Okay, so now we're in Portland. You're practicing there?
Yeah. I practiced a couple of different situations there. So I'd come out of dental school, right?
Right.
I worked as an associate for my family dentist. I started a practice from scratch. And then I moved to Portland. I kind of worked out of a buddy's office for a couple of months. And then I had an opportunity to buy into a practice that was not super healthy.
Okay.
So
you were like, that's the one I want to buy into.
Yeah. I mean,
you're like, that's a project.
Yeah. Well, okay. So part of the thing, right? I mean, and I'm sure some of your listeners feel this. You probably feel this at times. You get a little bored, right?
Totally.
So, you know, when I left Gearhart, I was feeling like, this practice is going really well. It was phenomenally successful.
And what type of dentistry were you doing at the time?
When I left, I was doing just what I wanted, right? When I started, I was doing everything.
Okay.
I was doing extractions, I was doing endo, I was seeing kids. And as I got busier and busier, I realized, you know, super quick, there was things that I suck at.
Sure.
And don't want to get better at.
Yeah.
But there are some things that I really want to get better at. So I was able to, over time, kind of let go of some of those things I didn't want to do. Yeah. Right.
I'm seeing that happen in my own self right now.
Yeah.
So where were you honing in on?
Restorative dentistry, complex restorative dentistry. And in those days, even then, it's primarily adults.
Yeah. Okay. Cool.
Yeah.
So then you buy into this project practice.
Yeah. I bought the practice and spent 5 years-ish there. And during that time, I realized, okay, I can see the trajectory of this. So I know the outcome. I know this is going to work. And I'm still kind of feeling like I want to do something different. So the circumstances kind of lined up, right? So I was recently divorced. I'm single. I don't have a ton of money because of the divorce and I just bought this practice, but I was in a situation where I didn't have a lot of debt. Yeah. I was kind of like level with the world. So I'm starting from scratch. So it's like the perfect time to go into a residency. And so that's,
wow. Yeah.
I talked to a couple of program directors, a couple of residents and kind of, you know, wandered around in that space for a while. And then I realized, you know, what all the, like the best ceramists in the world at some point come through Southern California. So I really, based on that, wanted to be in Southern California. And so your options then are going to be Loma Linda, USC or UCLA, or the West LA VA. And UCLA, they actually get paid a stipend. So nice. Yeah. And the UCLA program is so strong and removable, which was really one of my weak points. So yeah. I was looking to reinforce that. So really long tradition of removable.
You know, it's fascinating because I feel like, you know, a lot of people will get stuck in a rut or of unhappiness or, you know, just doing what they're doing, you know, and it's pretty impressive to go from, you know, you had a lot of changes, you know, and going from there to there to there. And obviously you had extenuating circumstances that affected that. But was there not, I mean, did you not have fear about like, gosh, is going back to residency at this point, you know, I mean, how old were you at the time when you went back to residency?
I think I was, must've been like around 41.
Yeah.
Cause I think I left when I was 45. I think that's what we did the math.
Cause my gut is that, you know, that was a great decision for you, but or maybe not. We'll get to that in a second. But, you know, that's what's interesting is like, that's a huge step of faith at that point.
Yeah. Oh, yeah. Yes.
Just go for it. There was no like, was that a hard thing to do?
Yeah, for sure. Yeah, it was super hard. But I don't know how to explain it. I was stoked to go. I had some ideas about what I was going to learn, but also I knew that the challenges were going to be around the stuff that I think that I know.
Yeah.
That isn't correct.
Sure. I get that.
So
are you trying to set me up for this weekend? Is that what that was? Was that a jab?
Could be.
Well, there's probably some of that. That's good. Okay. So talk more about that. So you get there and you know that's coming probably.
Yeah. So I mean, I had that discussion with a couple of people when I interviewed, right? So the people that when you go to a residency interview, the people that are there in the same room with you are other, you know, people that are interested in the same stuff. And the two dentists who turned out to be my co-residents and like some of the best friends I've ever made were coming directly from dental school. And they're super clinicians.
Wow.
Got a totally different background, but we were all three of us, you know, wanted to go into the program for the same reason, because we dig that part of dentistry. And that's kind of where you want to live.
Sure. So was it worth it?
Yeah, it was. And how do you gauge that?
It's true.
So, you know, if you ask me, would I do it again? Because there's a heavy price to be paid, right? Not dollar amount, but there's a heavy price.
Yeah.
So heavy price to pay. But I would do it again in a second.
Wow.
Yeah.
That's awesome. So, okay, then let's talk about that. So you leave residency. And how does it then start impacting, like, what happened next? Because you obviously are very confident about that decision,
yeah,
meaning that you would do it again. So what was the impact that it had?
Yeah, well, where I wasn't confident was, what do I do after this?
Okay.
So I grew up in the Northwest, and which growing up in the Northwest, especially on the west side of the Northwest, means you're wet and cold most of the time.
Yeah.
So I was kind of tired of that.
And now you're dry and hot and
Yeah. I mean, okay, well, let's get rid of that myth for just a second.
Okay. That's what we all think in Nashville. That everyone walks around in board shorts and flip-flops. It's gorgeous every time. All the women are beautiful.
Well, a lot of that's true.
Okay.
But I didn't see any of it.
Okay.
Because I'm working like 16-hour days basement.
Forget that.
A basement at UCLA. So we're working super long days, you know, 6.5, 7 days a week. And our whole team, everyone in the program, we always testing vitamin D deficient. We had like bottles of vitamin D supplements. We'd never get outside. We're the, it doesn't matter where you are, it turns out.
Yeah.
But a great program. I had a great time there. So the uncertainty was, now what am I going to do with this afterwards, right? Because you got a lot of options, but you still, you know, the problem is you got a lot of good options. So you got to kind of sort through that. So I was actually had in front of me the documents to sign for a practice in Orange County. I was going to go back into private practice for the most part. And then we're trying to kind of at the time figure out what my educational situation was going to be continuing on with UCLA. So is it work like a day a week or 2 days a week or something at the university? And I was in the master's program. I was trying to complete a research project. And so there was a lot of things I wanted to actually continue doing at UCLA. And so Orange County was close enough that I could still make that stuff happen. So I'm in the middle of this, and I get a call from a buddy here, Steve Ratcliffe, and he says, hey, we got a project. It's very ill-defined, this project. You're going to have to be okay with not like kind of, no, I can't give you a description of what you're going to do when you get here. But
it's a unique opportunity.
You want to come try it? And so I'd been a student of Frank's, of friends with Greg and Bob for a long time. And I came all the way through our curriculum here, not from the Seattle days, but then also once Spirit Education moved to Scottsdale, I came through all the workshops here. I was a member of the visiting faculty, so I know, you know, pretty intimately. I know the curriculum, I know the system and all that. So it was a good fit, we felt like, and so I moved over directly from UCLA.
Wow.
Here. Yeah.
And then the rest is history to some degree.
Yeah, it's funny. Now that I mentioned that, I think I left some human epithelial cells in the refrigerator there.
So when then, I mean, was it, have you missed the private practice aspect of things?
Well, it's funny. So I saw patients all day yesterday.
Okay. So you're still getting to feel fit, like, you know, see a lot of that nip.
I still get that haggard feeling everyone gets at the end of the day, and I go home and my eyeballs hurt, my back hurts and all that. So the difference is, you know, I don't do it 4 days a week or whatever the kind of average is. And it's not, it's, I mean, it's really sporadic. So, Monday, Tuesday, Wednesday, I'm able to see patients and we're going to start our workshop on Thursday and I will continue on in workshops for 9 days straight. Wow. I've got a Saturday and Sunday in there somewhere. So I'll take my 4-year-old to swim lessons and then I'll start seeing patients again the following week. And I don't have any workshops. So like that week is stacked so with you'll patients.
Go, wow. Okay. Yeah. Nice. Okay. So let's talk about then the type of dentistry you're doing here.
Yeah.
What all are you doing on a day-to-day basis with these cases?
Well, part of it's random. Some of it's random. So like I've got family members that I see. My practice is weird, right? It's not like, like you'll never find my webpage right now.
Sure.
You have to become a patient. You kind of like, you got to know my cell phone or I guess you have to find out where I live here. I'm a little bit overbooked right now. So I'm taking new patients, but I'm looking for specific patients that can fill educational needs for our stuff. So if there's something cool, some point teaching point that looks awesome, I'm way more likely to accept the case. If not, you know, I've got a team of folks that I can refer you to. But the kind of dentistry I'm doing is typically the kind of stuff we're doing here. So you're not going to see me treating a lot of kids. That still freaks me out.
Yeah, me too.
I love them. I just they really freak me out. But I do comprehensive restorative cases, and I'm primarily living in the full arch edentulous world. Like I'm working on a full mouth reconstruction that's only got 2 implants.
Wow.
And all the rest teeth. Right. So that's kind of unusual for me to see that many teeth. But that's the kind of stuff I'm doing, I guess.
Okay. So let's totally switch topics a little bit and start getting a little clinical per se.
All right.
So I'm here this weekend actually for, what's the full title? Edentulous full archness. That's what I keep telling people. I'm not sure exactly what I'm going there. Complete restorative full archness.
It's funny. This is actually one of the projects that I was originally kind of tasked with, right, when I got here. So the nickname for this was the denture course.
Okay.
But it's not a denture course. It's no one would sign up for a denture course. I don't. Maybe you would.
You know, that's probably somewhere that's missing. Is a good solid denture course would actually be a great CE course.
Well, put that up.
Everything starts with a good solid denture.
Well, that's where we start this workshop.
Okay.
So the workshop that you're here for is restoring the edentulous arch. So the way that Doug Benting and I designed this is we wanted to create kind of a big picture view of what are all the options available for edentulous patients or patients who are going to be edentulous, right? So terminal dentitions, you really got 3 patients. You get the existing edentulous patient with healed ridges. You got the terminal dentition patient. You got a patient who's been treated previously,
sure,
right?
Sure.
So, but they all need the same stuff. So the challenge is in continuing education right now, at least in North America, everything that you can get your hands on or get your brain around is designed around a technique or a prosthetic design, right? So I'll pick on All-on-4. You want to go learn All-on-4? You can do that. You can do it in a weekend or a couple of days or whatever, and you can get really good at that one technique. But what you don't learn is—
There's fundamentals.
Yeah. You don't learn what are the other options.
Right.
Like, what do I do if this thing doesn't work? What do I do, you know, if the patient's got a high smile line? You got to know more than that, right? So that's kind of how we put the workshop together. So rather than focus on, you know, one technique and going really in depth in one technique, we took this approach where let's create a systematic look at what are kind of categorically, what are all the options?
Sure.
And then how do you make sense of that? How do you figure out which system or which prosthetic design is going to work best for this patient? And if you alter that, if you deviate from that, what are the pros and cons, right? So So, and I've done a lot of that work with Riccardo Matroni.
That's pretty slick. And you know, you make a good point too, because the majority of stuff right now, like I saw somebody upstairs who was asking, they were saying, how are you, you know, how do you, if you're in a, cause look, all these young dentists, for the most part, want to place implants. You know, that's something everybody wants to do right now. It's hot. Patients want them. So like, you know, whether they want to, whether they know anything about it or not, they want to play implants. And then the next step becomes is like, okay, well, gosh, you know, and Instagram, for better or for worse, can be this like, you know, goal seeking. I see you smiling. You know, yeah. It can be this kind of like pie in the sky. Well, gosh, they're doing it. I want to do that. I want to do full arch implants. And that becomes a very, very flashy thing. And, you know, and then people toss around the numbers and what you can make, what you can do at it. And it's like, people want to do more of that. But the problem is like, where do you start? How do you get involved in that? And that's kind of the question I continue to get, because when you look at implant education around the country, a lot of it's focused on single units. You know, and even big core curriculums that are maybe like a year-long residency or whatnot, they spend very little time getting into the full arch, you know, realm. So I think there's a lot of need there for that.
I totally agree. And so, you know, when you dip your toes in the world of the full arch implant reconstruction, you kind of like have to be prepared for what happens if things don't go according
to
plan.
See, I tend to be more of like a, you know, figure out the solution to the problem once I get to the problem kind of guy.
Yeah.
For better or for worse.
Yeah, but that's how a lot of clinicians are rolling these days, right?
Because we
don't have a good system for helping people understand this. Right. So what happens is, you know, maybe you get a little bit in school, maybe you get a little bit in residency, maybe you get a little bit in a, you know, in a study club or a workshop or whatever. And then, okay, I'm picking on all on four, but it's fixed hybrid.
Sure.
Locator overdenture, the two that most people are familiar with. You learn the two locator overdenture situation, and you're like, now you're looking at four patients for whom that's appropriate.
Right.
But you got a bunch of other edentulous patients that might, maybe you want to do something else.
Or you get into a position like me, which is where you do that on a patient, and then 3 years later, you know, your implants are failing for whatever reason, and, you know, you're now having to figure out, one, why did that happen and what could you have done differently? And, you know, was that the right, you know, diagnosis or treatment plan in the first place? Just because, again, you don't know what you don't know.
Yeah. And I mean, a simple thing, a good example of that is you give the patient the locator overdenture, right? And maybe the conversations come up that you'll have to change the nylon inserts.
Yeah.
But typically what doesn't come up is the fact that the abutments wear. And so you'll have to change the abutments at some point. And there's cost associated
with
that. Sure,
of course.
Right? So at some point, it's not uncommon to have a difficult conversation with a patient about, hey, you know, things are going really well, but the reason this is coming loose, we need to change the abutments out. So
do you feel like we're starting to see, or are you starting to see personally more and more cases of like where you're having to deal with issues of stuff that was done poorly? Because I'm assuming we're going to see more and more of that, especially in the implant realm.
I don't want to say like poorly, but a lot of the stuff that I see, right? Because, okay, now my experience is jaded, because the people that come through our curriculum, like all of our students, when they go home, if they see something that's completely, you know, just like wrecked, they send me the picture.
Sure.
And say, what do you think about this?
Yeah.
So when you say, am I seeing a lot of
then
things
yes,
that are jacked up?
That's
all I see.
Right.
So, and then I got to go to Instagram to see the stuff that looks beautiful for whatever reason. So I think there's a lot of misunderstanding about, you know, just basic biologic fundamentals around some of these prosthetic designs. And clinicians will rely on someone who they think knows better than them, which
sure.
often is a technician, right? Technicians have preferences for what they want to do.
And you're not kidding. When I first started getting into that, the full arch implant stuff, it was definitely, I was asking the technician, you know, I don't know. What material is the right for this case? You know, I'll admit that. I mean, that's just
for sure
where
but
I
that,
was.
That's how we learn. And so we'd lean on someone who we think should know better, right? So the technician, they've got more experience, or your surgeon. If you're a restorative dentist,
sure.
you might lean on your surgeon. So, and having been recently at a residency and working with surgical residents, yeah, for sure. Those guys come out of their programs knowing a lot about prosthetic treatment planning, but still, I mean, it's kind of on us as the restorative person to come up with a design and then be, I don't want to say we have to overpower the conversation, right? Because I for sure, I don't want to shut down the opinion of the other people on my interdisciplinary team. At the same time, I have to be an equal member. I have to be able to have a strong voice in where I want the case to go because I'm the one who's going to be saddled with it.
You're the one that owns it. Yeah, totally. I get that. What about, let's talk about something that I'm always discussing with people, and that's, and I'm actually interested to hear, you know, your take on it this weekend as we move from a, you know, an analog world to a digital world. And obviously you have a unique perspective on that, you know, being from a process standpoint, which is probably a more traditional analog. And then next door, you have CEROC Doctors, you know, which is the ultimate trying to push the limits digitally. So how do we, how do you see those meshing right now? And, you know, what are your thoughts on all that?
So I was just at the American Academy of Aesthetic Dentistry meeting in Banff a week ago, and Van Ramos, the director of grad pros at University of Washington, gave a really nice presentation about how he's managing that in his program. And we think about that very similarly. Everything that we can do digitally is fundamentally the same as the way we would do it in the analog world. What you need to accomplish, the biologic factors, the biomechanical factors, all the same. So I have no problem with digital, but I it's just a tool to me. It's not going to solve problems that, you know, I can't solve in other ways. But if it makes me more efficient or it makes me more predictable, happy day. I'm using digital all the time. And I may use a lot of digital on one case. I may use a little bit digital on one case. I may not use any digital. Like I just inserted a couple of units on implants that were metal ceramic technology. So super old school. But you know, digital is here.
So what's your deciding factor then? And whether you're going to, when, whether you're, cause obviously the push or benefit to it is, can you, you know, can it make you more efficient? You know, in theory, can it save you more money? And then, you know, is it more patient centric in that you're alleviating some of the things like impressions and stuff like that the patients don't, you know, prefer? So when are you feeling, so with those being a lot of the pros, when are you trying to, when do you feel like you can't do that or you prefer still more of an analog technique?
Well, to answer that, you look at what's the weak point of digital right now?
Soft tissue?
It's getting the output out, right? So I can make a really accurate full arch scan, and I can make that full arch scan on teeth. Okay. I can make a pretty good scan on implants, depending on which article you look at. It's getting better. I could scan an edentulous arch, but then how do I do my work? So let's say a single full coverage crown, right? I want to make a single full coverage crown. If once I scan the case, once I scan the patient, I can't really get that out of the digital world right now until I have the crown in my hand.
Yeah, you have to design, create, and live in the digital world the whole way through almost.
Yeah, because the weak point right now is the printed model, or how do you get a model, a physical model that you can work on? And so I'm old enough that I'm used to working on stone casts, right? So the way my brain works, it's really, you know, deeply connected to my hands. So like things like trying to figure out functional treatment plans and feel the patient's, you know, steepness of the guidance and stuff like that. I feel for those things on an articulator. And so the challenge for me has been, how do I gain that same sense of what's happening with the occlusion, let's say on a virtual articulator when I'm looking at a screen? Because again, the weak link is, how do you get a cast that you could mount up and look at and feel it in your hands? Until we solve the problem of the inaccuracy with printed models, it's still like the challenge is you can't get the information out. So I know really high-end technicians that, you know, have kind of got workarounds and stuff in the laboratories, but for the general kind of all-around case, it's working with CEROC, right? So let's pick on that. You're going to do a single unit on 14 full coverage. You don't need a model for that. The patient now becomes the articulated casts. Right. And so you got to work out, you know, make sure that you evaluate the occlusion and the contacts and everything like that. So there's pros and cons. But what's, I would say for sure, is that digital does not replace the thought process.
Totally.
It's just, it's a tool.
In fact, I'd argue that you really need to know it almost more, because then you're having to manipulate a lot of things. You got to be thinking about all the different steps that are sometimes, they're happening maybe in a combination of steps, right? And so if you don't know it, if you don't understand it at that base level, then you could be really screwed.
Yeah, it's really easy to miss a step if you're relying on like the software going or, from or screen the technician, to screen.
Right?
Yeah, of course.
Because yeah. That's the easy part is, okay, well, what do you need? You know, you're getting them, okay, I got you the DICOM, I got you the arches, and now you just make me what I need, you know, or like that doesn't.
That's one of the nice things about a grad program is you wind up doing a lot of your own lab work. I still do a lot of my own lab work, which is, I guess, maybe the reason I have so few patients. I mean, I'm really, really slow at it. But what you learn when you do your own lab work is, I mean, you're really, you're critiquing your own preps. You really have an understanding of how things can get screwed up in the lab. And that basic understanding, that experience, helps you troubleshoot when you're in the operatory, you're trying to insert whatever type of case, and it's not going well. You can think backwards and do a little bit better job of troubleshooting, I think.
What is your what's your favorite full arch way to restore somebody? If you could take all biologics function, everything else of it, and you had to, got to make one restoration, what would it be? Our material or, you know, whatever it is.
So I was up last night. So I got, this is a case actually, it's going to show up in somewhere at some point. It's a person who's close to the family, and she's got on the maxilla, she's got, you know, partially edentulous, and she's got had some old crown and bridge from Eastern Europe. And she like wants to get restored. The mandible, she's kind of bilateral distal extension situation, Kennedy class two. And the teeth are kind of all over the place. And she's a patient who, like, if I showed you the pictures, we could have a really good conversation about, do you edentulate her?
Yeah.
I mean, because you could go—
Great question.
You could go both arches on her. And that would solve a lot of problems. You could restore her with fewer implants, and it's going to be way less costly. But what am I going to do with her? I'm going full-on crown and bridge style. So, you know, what would I want in my mouth? If I have the option, I think full mouth. Yeah, if I have the option, I want to save as many teeth as I can. The trouble is they're not always in the right place. So we'll often—
Are they willing to do ortho?
Yeah. So sometimes you got to sacrifice teeth in order to not compromise the entire arch.
So let's discuss that, because that to me is a super interesting conversation is, you know, are we getting too quick to shuck teeth? You know, at what point does it become, should we— push more people into ortho, into doing, to saving teeth, and not just be like, oh, well, they, you know, in order to meet your aesthetics and your function and what you want, then we need to shuck all your teeth and put in hybrids, you know? I mean, are we there?
Yeah. I think the first time you have a patient come back with a hybrid that's got complications or even, you know, expected sort of wear situation, like you realize maybe shouldn't be putting 100% of our patients in hybrids, fixed hybrids, metal and acrylic. You know, the teeth, denture teeth wear, the screws come loose. They're really, really tough to clean. Typically, you know, when you've got an edentulous patient, not all of them, but a lot of patients have lost their teeth due to neglect.
Yeah.
We're giving them a restoration that's essentially impossible to clean, right? It's a porous material. And expecting them to somehow sail off into the sunset and make that work. So no, at the end of the day, actually, the take-home message for me the last 5 or 6 years working on this edentulous arch workshop, one of the reasons I went into my grad program was I was really interested in how you treat full arch cases, and I didn't want to take the risk in my own practice.
Sure.
But one of the take-homes for me, I guess it's now closer to 8 or 9, 10 years, is preserve the teeth if you can, because that's going to preserve options for you, right? Yeah. If that's not going to work because of whatever the patient's circumstances are, okay, happy day, we can continue on because I got a lot of options that are available, but nothing's going to be as good as your teeth. I've got a ton of options that are really good alternatives to not having teeth.
Yeah.
But nothing's going to be better than having teeth.
I think part of the battle sometimes in that is that a lot of patients are coming in with, because they're getting on Google and they're seeing all these, you know, teeth in the day where they go from this to that. And they're like, oh, that's what I want. You know, so they come in with this pre, you know, notion of I want all my teeth taken out and that's the smile I want.
Love it. It's a great conversation starter.
Yeah, because so, you're it's telling you what they want, but then you just got to help them maybe get to the way that do it. Is it with isn't taking their teeth out?
Yeah. So they're, I mean, yeah, that to me is perfect. And yeah, that actually plays out. So some of the centers that are corporate kind of centers that are doing a lot of full arch reconstructions,
sure.
You get one of those that shows up in your town, you know what happens? Your numbers go up.
Yeah. I'm excited about that because we just got one of those big ones in Nashville. So I'm hoping that's going to happen.
Yeah. I mean, the numbers play out that if you're seeing those types of patients, they a lot of them will come to you and they'll have the same question that you just asked. Like, okay, here's what I want to do. Am I a candidate for this? And if you got a bunch of options, yeah, find the one that's going to be the most conservative for them or the most appropriate.
What's your biggest pet peeve that you see that you wish you could be, you know, make dentists stop doing or do differently when it comes to a lot of this stuff?
I don't know.
Like mine would be like one that I've like wish I could go back and like tell, you know, first and second year out of school, Sully, would be like, you know, soft tissue is really important. Yeah. And like you can't like, save attached tissue or think about that before you come up with your total treatment plan and think you're all done, you know, with implants and whatnot. That's one of my big ones.
Well, I mean, along that line, right? Everyone wants to learn how to place implants, but like, do you see people lining up for connective tissue graft courses and, you know, how are you going to do the contour grafting? What are you going to do for augmentation and stuff like that? Placing an implant, I mean, the process of placing the implant, drilling, and sure. It's ridiculous, right? It's so easy. Yeah. But managing the soft tissue around the implant is super complex. Like you want to have a believable gingival architecture, believable emergence. That's the difference between, you know, really good stuff and stuff that's just mediocre.
Well, and I found too, I do a lot on talking to doctors on cone beam and the value of cone beam and how, you know, awesome I think it is. But one area that I think it almost can be a negative is because yes, you could see where the bone is, which is good a lot of times because you know where you need to grow bone, but then the problem becomes is you feel like, oh, well, I can tweak it in right here, when really restoratively that doesn't work well, you know? Yeah. Like I found enough bone.
I have trained myself that when I have that same thought or when I actually verbalize that, can I fit the implant in here? Can I make this work?
Yeah.
Like that's a big red flag.
Yeah. Right?
So here, it's reverse engineering. Here's where I want the, you know, whatever, the restorative material. Here's where I need the tooth to be. So if the bone's not there, we either got to get the bone there or we're going to have to think differently about the case. And a lot of times, you know, maybe it's not an implant. It's
sure.
Going to be soft tissue augmentation and go with conventional crown and bridge.
So then, okay, on this note, here's a selfish question. You know, one of the constant, you know, discussions right now is, do you put a short implant in the maxilla or do you do a sinus bump and put an implant in the maxilla?
Yeah. So one of the problems is if you go to the literature, you know, and you're searching for an answer on that is what's your definition of a short implant? Because implants aren't,
I mean, let's say 7.5 millimeters shorter.
Yeah. So the research around 8 millimeter implants in the mandible, no problem.
Sure.
And the posterior maxilla is where things get dicey because then you got to compare, okay, What is the chance that my sinus augmentation is going to fail or have a complication,
right,
which would lead to an implant complication versus is it just simply going to be an implant complication? And so there's a lot of things that factor into it. So patient systemic health, the prosthetic design. So are the implants, you know, connected or the function of the patient, what kind of force and load are they putting on it? So there are so many variables that it's kind of tough to answer that. The downside with conventional sinus augmentation, right, is you're sometimes looking at 4 to 6 to 8, maybe 8 right. months of healing. So it really delays things. And so one of the options is, well, what if I tilt the implant? Would that work? Mm-hmm. Someone might say, well, let's skip the sinus altogether and go with zygos. Mm-hmm. I mean, there's pros and cons to everything. And so we kind of take that on case-by-case basis. There is evidence, though.
That's totally not the answer that I wanted.
Yeah, I know. I'd love to give you an answer.
because that's, I just feel like, okay, so assuming that the patient's healthy and whatnot, I mean, obviously to me where it becomes super is occlusion and trying to figure out that, you know, that aspect of things, because I don't know. Or like with these internal sinus bumps, how solid is that bone becoming, you know, up there that we're putting in there anyways, you know, yeah, with the implant? Like, is that really giving us any more stability, or is it just the cortical plate that we're engaging and giving it, you know what I'm saying? Like, is that extra 4 millimeters of, we bumped it 6 millimeters. Like, am I really getting much more stableness from that?
Yeah, no one knows. I mean, that's the problem. No one knows. And so then you risk, okay, if you have any crestal bone loss, if you've got a 7 millimeter implant and 4 millimeters at the apex of that implant, you're not getting any biologic support from, right? you get any crestal bone loss, the whole situation is going to be in jeopardy. So, I mean, there are a lot of factors that play into it.
What do you find yourself doing more of? I'm going to get an answer out of you, dadgummit.
Short implants versus sinus augmentation depends on how short. An 8 millimeter implant, I think there's a lot of evidence that that's probably going to be fine.
So that's kind of where you're going to start the line, is you'd like to get an 8 millimeter in there.
Yeah, but there's also evidence, and I'd have to go back and look at the numbers, because there are sinuses, right, that don't have much native bone left. So if you're going to do a sinus aug and, you know, you want to place an 8 or a 10 millimeter implant in a, like essentially 100% grafted sinus, mm-hmm, what are the odds of that working? Mm. And the problem is, you know, there's some factors that are operator dependent. There's some factors that just
appear to be
just luck, right?
Yeah.
So it's tough. It's tough to answer that without saying it's case by case.
No, I get that. All right. Well, that's fine. You be that way then. Yeah. All right. So.
But the mandible, you can do whatever you want.
Yeah. Well, that's the problem though, is the mandible, you know, becomes very forgiving with the, you know. And I'll have implants that, you know, I had one a couple weeks ago where it was a, you know, a little sinus bump. Probably like I ended up being, we'll call it 4 millimeters of bone to begin with. And then we put a 9 millimeter implant or something like that in there. You know, when we put the implant in, the ISQ stability, everything is good. But then, you know, 8 months down the road, the implant's coming out. And, you know, my guess is occlusion or something of that nature, but, you know.
It's the challenge is, what's the etiology of the implant failure, right? Is it a graft failure? Is it a technique failure? Right. Is there, you know, was the implant contaminated?
Do you do you spend a lot of time when you have things fail? I mean, you may not have any things fail, but I'm sure you have some that, you know, you spend a lot of time trying to really dial down that etiology that.
Yeah. One of the cool things about being in the residency wasn't doing the dentistry, right? Was being able to follow up cases that had been done by previous residents.
Mm, yeah.
So you get to see things that work, and you get to see things that like just completely fail, and you get to see all the stuff that's in between. So you get a really like a strong sense of kind of how designs age, generally speaking. And so it helps develop kind of your gut around stuff like that.
Sweet. Well, dude, this has been fantastic. I have really enjoyed this. I'm super excited. Restoring the edentulous arch, I nailed it this week. I'll definitely be giving, you know, we've followed up with some feedback and letting the listeners know about it, but I'm very excited. So, you know.
It's all right. It's a good.
It's be good.
It's a good
workshop. No pressure. Just don't screw it up, you know.
No, it's a good workshop. It's, it's of all the projects that I've done, this is one that I'm probably most proud of, because it's so different compared to what you can typically find in the educational space.
Well, I'm excited. Well, Doc, thank you so much for joining the podcast, and we'll have to do it again because I have lots more clinical questions.
All right, Sully. Good. Thanks, man.
All right. Everybody work smarter, not harder. We'll see you next time.
Thank you for listening to The Millennial Dentist. Visit us online at millennialdentist.com.